Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Katie Singer. Katie Singer's last book, An Electronic Silent Spring, reports on the effects of electromagnetic radiation emitted by mobile phones, Wi-Fi, and cellular antennas on wildlife and public health. Her current work focuses on the internet's energy use, extraction demands, greenhouse gas emissions, toxic waste, and worker hazards. Katie spoke about the internet's footprint at the United Nations 2018 Forum on Science, Technology, and Innovation. In 2019, she spoke on a panel with Dr. James Hansen about the internet's impacts on climate disruption. Her websites are www.ourweb.tech, O-U-R-W-E-B.T-E-C-H, and www.electronicsilentspring.com. So first off, thank you for your work in the world as always. And second, thank you for being again on the program.
I'm really glad to be here.
So today, let's talk about what's wrong with electric vehicles.
Yes. And you sent that email to me last night, and I had a really interesting response. I would like to talk about our thinking about electric vehicles.
Okay.
And I want to explain how that's different for me from talking about what's wrong with electric vehicles. So, okay, if you go to a new car dealer, there will be stickers on it saying how much fuel the vehicle uses during its operation and what the greenhouse gas emissions are from the vehicle. And you can also go to fueleconomy.gov, and they'll tell you these same things, like if it's a traditional gas vehicle, if it's a hybrid, if it's an electric vehicle. And if you're getting an electric vehicle, it'll say zero emissions. Now, pretty much everyone I know wants to do good by the environment. I don't know anyone who would say, I want to damage the environment. And so we're all interested in doing what we can to preserve this beautiful world. The trouble is here that we are only thinking about the vehicle's energy use while it operates. We're neglecting to think about what happens when we design the vehicle, how much energy is used when we design the vehicle, when we start extracting the raw materials that will be used for it, when we smelt and refine those raw materials, when we ship them between stations, when we manufacture solvents and ship those to the final assembly plant, all of that stuff. We don't look at the waste. What happens when this product reaches the end of its usable life? We don't look at that when we're looking at that fueleconomy.gov information. How will the waste, the discard of this vehicle, impact ecosystems? And we also don't look at the infrastructure necessary for this vehicle to operate. We're not looking at the roads. We're not looking at the charging stations. So I've just kind of gotten started. But what we need to do is look at our thinking around every single product we buy. And that is what needs to change. And then when we start looking at the bigger picture, the cradle to grave life cycle of every product we buy and the infrastructure necessary for making this vehicle operate or any product, I don't care if it's a blender or a hairdryer or whatever, then our thinking changes. And then we can begin to, I would say, respond realistically to the limits imposed on us by the limits of nature, by reality. As long as we don't look at that whole picture, then we can just go around saying, I'm doing great for the environment because I'm not emitting any greenhouse gas emissions while I drive this car. And that's ignoring, we could safely say 80% of the energy consumed by the vehicle's cradle to grave energy use. I just said a mouthful.
So I have a couple responses. One of them is that let's say that you or I had access to the button that would set off a nuclear war. And as we walk across the room to push this button, we are in that moment emitting essentially zero carbon. The point being that I'm just reiterating or validating that we need to take context into account that of course if you're walking to push a button that's going to set off a thermonuclear war, then of course it doesn't really matter. What matters is the button that gets pushed and then what happens when the button gets pushed. It's not how much emissions that you put out when you walked across the room. That's one thing. Next thing is, I read an article a while ago that was exactly what you're talking about. The first sentence of it was something about, as I drive through this pristine environment, the only pollution I can see or the only pollution around is that coming from the tailpipe of my automobile. And I mean, so he ignored the roads, he ignored the energy that went into making the car, he ignored, you know, all the houses he was driving through. The only thing that mattered was the actual emissions from the tailpipe. And that's just an example of a mainstream journalist doing exactly what you're talking about.
So every one of us on planet Earth is complicit with what's going on here. And I've been really aware of the energy embodied in the things I use on a daily basis. So, for example, I've stopped using a dryer, and I'll dry our clothes on a laundry line outside. But it's smoky now, and so then I don't want the clothes to absorb the smoke, so I use the dryer. I could give lots of examples where, because I have the option to go to electronics, I do it. And right now, like I think I need another pair of shoes, and so I'm buying online, and that takes an incredible infrastructure for me to see the kinds of shoes I want. They still have to get shipped to me. They might not fit, and so then I have to send them back. I mean, everything is really involved. I'll notice. I tried growing some spinach, and I couldn't get them to germinate. I couldn't get the seeds to germinate. And I was, you know, watering twice a day and doing all the right things, but it didn't happen. And I went to the nearby grocery store and got this cellophane bag of spinach for $2. It was organic. It had been washed. It was so easy for $2. And I just keep seeing how easy it is in this society for me to buy things and not know what went into getting them into my hands. This is true for everything. And so I really keep looking at my part in this dynamic, and I keep seeing how hard it is for me, and I'm aware of this stuff all the time, and it is so hard for me to shift my thinking, to shift my behavior.
And that's one of the problems with all the cultural momentum, you know, and the whole system is set up to provide cheap consumer goods So let's go ahead, unless you got, go ahead.
Yeah. So that's true. And so then I'm wondering, as so many of us are noticing the collapse of society as we know it, and that I would, you know, I mean, I feel incredibly privileged that I would have spinach available to me at a price I can afford. Anyway, as we're noticing the collapse of things we have expected for the last few decades or whatever, how do we start thinking constructively about the future? And the future is what I'm thinking of buying today. Like, if I mean, so my car is 26 years old and I just drive it around town and it's fine. And I have a mechanic who knows how to repair it. I don't have the money to buy a newer used car, but I know that if I got a chunk of money, I might start thinking, well, do I get a newer used car? Or could I instead think, well, why would I do that? Okay, it's the paint is chipped and, you know, it's not exactly the most attractive car on the road, but do I really care about that? My mechanic is still alive and well and nearby, and so do I just, it's actually environmentally better to keep this guzzler driving as long as possible than for me to get a newer car. But I have to talk myself through that.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And I knew a guy when I was a teenager. I knew a guy who had a thing for Ford Falcons, if you can remember those. And he would buy them for $1 a piece, just pieces of junk, and then he would drive them until they collapsed by the side of the road, and then he would hitchhike home and go to the next one. And his plan was actually far more economical than buying a good car, 'cause he would get thousands of miles or tens of thousands of miles out of the Falcon, as long as he didn't mind at some point down the road he's going to get stuck, because at some point it's going to throw a rod or something else. So speaking of cars, let's go back, and I think you've set up a wonderful framework. So now can we talk about some of the hidden costs, or the costs of electric vehicles that most of us don't think about? And hold on, before we do that, I'm going to do an internet search real quick for electric vehicles. Say,
go to fueleconomy.gov.
I'm going to go to, hold on, electric vehicles save the planet. even, okay, here's a Wired article. Even more evidence that electric cars could save the planet. Some at least have a question mark at the end of the sentence. You can help save the planet in an electric car. U.S. News and World, electric cars won't save the environment. Carbonfreeslow.org, electric vehicles are good for people in the environment. So let's talk about what goes into an electric car.
Okay. So we start with design, and that is actually an energy-intensive process, because there will be robotics involved and computers that take tremendous energy. I don't really know details here beyond what I've just said, but design is not a simple process anymore. So there's design. That's first. Then the next step would be to acquire the substances that are going to go into the vehicle. An electric vehicle can have between 50 and 100 computers. I know with a smartphone, every smartphone has more than 1,000 substances. So I don't know how many substances are in each computer in a vehicle, but let's be conservative and say, well, there could be 500 substances per computer. So a lot of those are going to be rare earth metals or conflict minerals, and they need extraction, and then they need smelting, refining. They're going to need transportation between stations. And I should say cargo shipping is a profound energy guzzler and polluter. So if cargo shipping were a country, I believe it would rank number six, in greenhouse gas emissions. The fuel used by cargo ships, I don't remember the name of it, but
it's bunker fuel.
Bunker fuel, thank you. It really acidifies our oceans, and it's just a terrible thing. And in order for any ore to be smelted and, you know, and prepared for the battery or for a computer, or, you know, there's so many things involved. It's going to be transported internationally between stations a lot. So then after extraction and smelting and refining, we're going to need solvents for the computer's circuit boards. We're going to need plastics that will get bent and metals that will get bent. And that, again, takes a lot of energy. And then we need assembly plants. We're going to be creating hazardous conditions for workers all over. And then we've got the final product, and we're going to need the battery on an electric vehicle is quite substantial. There was a recent study that came out that it compares conventional and electric vehicles, and an electric vehicle has already emitted 30,000 pounds of carbon dioxide before it arrives at a dealership. A conventional car has emitted 14,000 pounds. Now, so you see, we're not at zero emissions. I can read something else here that's pretty staggering. This came from UK's Natural History Museum. Their scientists reported that replacing all of UK's vehicles with electric vehicles, it would take 208,000 tons of cobalt, 264,000 tons of lithium carbonate, at least 7,200 tons of neodymium and dysprosium, those are magnets, and 2,362,000 tons of copper. Now, no ore comes out of the earth in a usable form. So you've got to reduce the metal from the ore, and that requires smelting and refining. And I'm learning a little about that in preparing electronic grade silicon, for example. The first step, you take pure quartz gravel, then you need a hard, dense, moist wood, and then you need a pure carbon. This can be something like petroleum coke from the tar sands. You ship those three things, the quartz, the wood, and the pure carbon, to a smelter that is kept at 1800 degrees Fahrenheit for 6 or 7 years at a time. You cannot power a smelter like that with renewable power because you've got to have continuous power. You can't interrupt it or you'll blow up the factory. So you need continuous power from a source like coal, natural gas, nuclear power, hydro power. Batteries are not going to be sufficient. And if you have solar or wind, well, when the wind stops blowing or the sun stops shining, then you'll interrupt the delivery of electricity. And that is not going to work for a smelter. But that is only the first step in smelting. With silicon, there are, I believe, 4 steps. Each of them is energy intensive. And also greenhouse gas emitting, ultimately. And nuclear power doesn't emit greenhouse gases while it's operating, but a nuclear power plant takes a lot of concrete, and manufacturing concrete is very energy intensive and greenhouse gas emitting. So, okay, I'm just getting started, but you see how you begin to see I don't even know what to say. The soup that we're making, the recipe here, is not a zero emissions situation.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You're being very, very clear.
If we look at the battery situation, we're still talking about electric vehicles. So to date, they're using a lot of cobalt. And I've got figures here. Producing cobalt for batteries requires approximately 7,000 to 8,000 kilowatt hours of electricity for every ton of metal produced. 9,000 kilowatt hours per ton for copper. So electric vehicles certainly use cobalt for the batteries and a lot of copper in the motors and in the computers. And there's a study from the U.S. Geological Survey that found that for every kilogram of copper mined, at least 21 kilograms of waste are generated. I can say that again. For every single kilogram of copper that you mine, you will generate at least 21 kilograms of waste. I can also talk about cobalt. I have seen pictures of mines that might be, it looks like a tunnel in the dirt, say 18 or 20 inches in diameter. And then I've seen young teenage boys climb into that tunnel. I know that such children have been maimed or buried alive while mining for cobalt. That, you know, right now, cobalt is used in Tesla batteries, in the electric vehicle's batteries. We're not looking at that kind of stuff when we want to do good by the environment and get a new vehicle. And so the question then becomes, I'm saying so much here, but I think it's more, if this doesn't work, if it doesn't work to manufacture a new vehicle because it ravages the earth, it ravages the people who are working to create the vehicle, and then I haven't talked about the tailings, the waste generated while mining, while smelting, while refining stuff, while washing the ores, what happens, or with waste, you know, what happens when batteries are at the end of their life, how that impacts waterways. What are the new questions that we need to ask in that really look at what are our limits? What is possible if we really don't want to harm the environment anymore? If we really don't want to harm young children, what do we do?
So, okay, do you want me to just ask that question back of you? What do we do? Or another question I've been thinking is, why/how is it that we, I mean, everything you're saying, you're providing information, and that's great, but it's not cognitively challenging. It's not like, it's not a big stretch to recognize that a car had to be manufactured and the manufacturer had the required raw materials, and these raw materials came from somewhere, and there are costs associated with them, and someone, and the places where the raw materials came from were someone's home, so a human's home and a non-human's home. And that's not cognitively challenging. Why don't we do it more often? Do you see what I'm asking?
It's a great question. Why do you think we don't do it more often? Or I don't even know. Or wait, let me ask it another way. Where can you think of places where we do ask that question?
Okay, this pisses me off, okay? Not you, but the subject, because my first form of environmental activism was as a forest activist, and it, even in the 80s and 90s, it was really clear to me that, so if you cut down the forest near a stream, that's going to harm the salmon who live in the stream through sedimentation, through increasing water temperature. And people can get really anti-environmentalists would refuse to see those links. But at the same time, you would see headlines in the newspaper that because of a spike in the Japanese housing market, therefore we need to cut more trees here because the Japanese need more wood. And so my point is, they recognized, it was a selective inattention, that they recognized that the global economy is interdependent, but they refused to recognize that the forest is interdependent. Do you see what I'm trying to get at? That when it serves them, or not when it serves them, is too conscious, but there are circumstances in which they easily see the linkages, and there are circumstances in which they don't see the linkages. And one of the things that taught me early on is that it's a question of willful inattention as opposed to, oh, it's just too complicated, we don't understand. I mean, they understand that when a Walmart comes into town, that, or any big box store, when any big box store comes into town, the local people will, or the local governments will, give them a tax break because they know that the wages will, they hope, provide more taxes than they lost in giving the property tax break to them. That's the whole idea behind encouraging them to come there. And so they understand that there can be secondary and tertiary effects there. But again, when it comes to an electric car, they just see the shiny new thing. They don't actually see everything that went into it. So it's my, I'll stop now after one more sentence, which is,
yeah, go.
It's not a cognitive inability to perceive these interlinkings, because they can do it when it serves them. That's all.
I was in Oregon in February, and I gave a batch of talks, including one about electric vehicles. And people attended who love electric vehicles. And it was really interesting because after I spoke, They were kind of speechless. They didn't know a lot of the things that I reported. They genuinely did not know. And they genuinely care about the environment. And one of the cities where I was in Eugene was considering getting, I don't know if it was their buses or their police vehicles or just the vehicles they needed for the city, they were thinking of going electric. And they were really wrestling with the idea because of what I reported. And so I'll just say, I think people genuinely want to do good for the environment. Certainly there are people who are selling new electric vehicles who would be in favor of it, but there are people, you know, anybody who's selling something is usually in favor of getting buyers. I don't see that people are willfully ignoring the information. I see, I'll just keep talking about my own challenges as I see. You know, if I don't have money available, say, for buying a new car, well, then I just keep, I keep repairing what I've got. And if I do have money, like I really need new shoes. That's a thought. I mean, the ones that I have don't have holes in them, but I think I'm ready for a new pair of shoes. And so then I just go for my new pair of shoes. I don't really think about how much went into the shoes. If I need spinach, only because I was having so much trouble growing my own spinach, did it even occur to me how privileged I am to be able to buy a $2 bag of organic washed spinach just by going to my grocery store half a mile away. So I don't see that I live, I just don't have this habit of looking at what it takes to manufacture anything. Now, say that I lived with a woodworker who made our furniture. Well, then I would have a really good idea of what goes into making a table or something. We bought this bookshelf file cabinet thing a few months ago. It was used. And the roller on the file cabinet was broken. And this wonderful man came to our house and tried to repair it. And it took a couple of trips just to get this little wheel to work again. And then it broke again as soon as it was repaired. I'm just so aware of what it takes to manufacture anything and to repair anything. And then when you have electronics involved, wow. I'll say it again. One smartphone includes 1,000 substances. And we're just not, we just expect things to work. It's just how it is now. We're so far removed from a life where we had, you know, if we wanted a new table, we would have to make it. If we wanted spinach, we would have to grow it or trade with a neighbor who did grow it.
So I don't disagree with you, and we don't have the capacity to recognize the time or the energy to do this at every moment for everything. I mean, at some point, you just want to eat something, and you don't want to think about everything that went into it. At some point. And I realize it's nice to be able to flip a switch and a light comes on and you don't have to think about where the electricity came from, the miles of wiring. I understand that. I understand. And most of us, most of the time, you know, when I'm walking around wearing shoes, I don't normally think about where the shoes came from. I mean, of course. All I'm trying to get at is that when it is presented, it's not, it should be pretty clear to people pretty quickly that this is a process that they can go through on their own if they so choose. That's all. Because it's not.
Well,
it's not
where I'm going.
Okay, go ahead.
Most of the people I talk with these days are excruciatingly aware that what we have expected of our society is collapsing. So even if you go to, a grocery store that 6 months ago was, you know, had totally full shelves, it's very rare for me now to go to a grocery store where all the shelves are completely stocked. I just don't see it. And so we're seeing that's, you know, supply chains are not what they used to be, and the shelves are not what they used to be. And school is completely discombobulated because we're going virtual now. And it just, everything is getting rearranged or it's collapsing. So it's a wonderful time to introduce this question of can we really afford this new device, this new technology? And then what does it mean to afford something? It includes the environmental costs. It includes the public health costs, the worker hazards. It's a time to introduce this question, and how do we get those questions into our discourse now as things are collapsing and our expectations are changing? This is the opportunity.
So can you answer that question? How do we get that into the conversation? I mean, just by doing what we're doing here and talking about it?
I think this is a start. And then I'll say I'm starting to ask it certainly myself, and even just telling you that I'm thinking of buying a pair of shoes, it has me thinking, okay, do I really need it? You know, yeah. Do I really need to go to the grocery store today, or do I have enough today? What are the kinds of things I need to stock up on, and what would have me going to the grocery store a little bit less? And then, like, I'm about to build another website. Do I really need it? Is there a way to do it that is not as energy intensive? Like, is there a way to how can I minimize that, the imprint of yet another website? Or do I just, you know, not do it? I have to start asking myself and I'll now I'm talking about the internet, what is too much media use for me? Or what are signs of too much media use? And how, you know, what's a good media diet for me? If I'm talking about transportation, I was sharing the conversation I had. I mean, I don't have the option right now of buying a new car or a newer car. But if I did, I might say, well, what's wrong with keeping what I've got? And so I need to start having that conversation pretty much with everything I take into the house. And I'm also asking it in terms of the stuff that I have in the house that I don't use. And I'm looking for places where this stuff could be usable. So I think, I don't know. How do we get those kinds of conversations happening? I certainly think of young people that because I want to have those conversations with younger people because I think they have perspectives I haven't thought of. And if they can start asking those questions for themselves, then that becomes habitual for them, and they're much younger than I am, and that's how we get the conversation happening more frequently in the culture.
You know, as you were saying that last little bit, I was thinking a lot about my mother, and she grew up in the Depression, born in 1933, and much of what you are talking about came pretty naturally to her because in her formative years, one year I remember for Christmas, she got an orange and this was a huge thing. And there were times where we would have conversations, the dryer is 30 years old and is starting to crap out. And I'm like, let's just get a new dryer. And he's like, no, we got to repair this one more time. And I think, so two things. One is I think that these skills can be learned very quickly and easily, and they were learned quickly by people in the Depression. It's just that through the go-go 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, double aughts, we forgot for a while. But I think that, and especially up until industrialism, this is how people were, that it was, I think about clothes a lot. I mean, I actually don't think about clothes because I don't care what I wear, but I think about them a lot in terms of use because the average person in the United States buys and throws away 60 pounds of clothes a year. And it was absolutely standard up until, not very long ago, for people to wear the shirt. And then when the shirt really starts falling off your back, you turn it into rags. Then when it's no longer useful as rags, then you use it for sort of toxic rags or to clean up nasty messes. And then it goes. And we now just dump them. That's a fairly recent change. I don't know what point I'm making, so take it anywhere you want.
If we go back to vehicles and just, I mean, I'm thinking of your mother born in 1933 and, well, what's the deal with a car? It's an incredible privilege to have a car. And I think, so my grandmother was born in 1903. And I believe in 1902, in the United States, there were a total of 150 miles of paved roads. So it didn't take long to cover the country with, I don't know how many how many, I just don't even know how many miles we have of paved roads. And so, yeah, and then to get to the kind of thinking that your mother has, I think we do need something like a depression or a collapse of available energy, you know, those kinds of situations, very dramatic, so that we don't have a choice except to limit our consumption. And we could say, well, some of us are in that right now with the pandemic and its economic fallout. But I don't know that we've gone all the way there. Some of us are still saying, okay, we're going to get back on track. We're going to get the economy going again. And there is this tremendous push for electric vehicles from environmentalists because we all want to see less greenhouse gas emissions. But we're not looking at the true costs. We're not looking at the extractions. We're not looking at the waste. We're not looking at the infrastructure. We haven't talked about what it takes to charge an electric vehicle. And, okay, it's not gasoline, but manufacturing and installing and operating and discarding of a charging station, those all take energy and rare earths, and there are toxic emissions along the way. So we need this fuller picture when we talk about this stuff, including with electric vehicles, including with solar-powered systems and wind-powered systems and dams. We need it with everything. So it's our thinking that we need to look at. That's the core stuff. Instead of focusing on what is wrong with manufacturing any one product, all products that we mass produce need to be looked at with these kinds of cradle-to-grave questions.
Well, we're pretty close to out of time, and we have like a couple minutes left, and that would be a wonderful note to end on. But is there anything else you want to say about any of this today to close?
I'm going to add one more thing about my co-writer here. I am working on a paper about electric vehicles, and I wrote it with Gary Olheft, who has 2 degrees in electrical engineering from MIT. He's a life member of IEEE. He's a PhD geophysicist, and among many things, he taught at the Colorado School of Mines for a couple of decades. And Gary,
what decades? You know, I went there, right?
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah. What decades did he teach?
He retired about 10 years ago, so probably after you were there.
Yeah, I graduated in 83.
I think he was working for EPA and stuff like that in those years.
Okay.
So Gary has Parkinson's, and 11 years ago, he got a deep brain stimulator that decreases the drugs he needs to take for the symptoms of Parkinson's. So he has this electronic device in his brain, and there are tons of wires that go through his neck to another pacemaker in his heart, at his heart. Okay, so he is walking around with an electronic device. Well, if he gets into a Prius, at every stoplight, when the car brakes, depending on what seat he's in, but anyway, the what happens in a Prius is you brake the car, and then the computers signal the battery to recharge. The magnetic fields emitted by the computers shut off his implant at every stoplight.
Oh, my God.
Now, this gets a little more complicated because 10% of the U.S. American population has some kind of medical implant. Now, we're going to get more complicated with electric vehicles because there is interest in getting induction chargers built into roads so that cars could charge while they drive. Right now, if you charge your electric vehicle overnight, it'll take a number of hours to do it, and then you might be able to get 300 miles on the per charge. Well, if you're going on a long-distance road trip or you're a truck driver, 300 miles isn't going to be enough, especially if it, you know, if it takes hours to recharge. But if we put induction chargers into roadways, well, then people could, the cars would recharge while we drive. Now, depending on their dosimetry and intensity, and there's a third thing, hold on, depending on their power, frequency, and dosage, induction chargers could reprogram Gary's implant, and it could be fatal for him. So that's another thing that we haven't looked at when we think, hey, how cool would this be? We've got the technology. Let's go forward and do it. We're just not doing due diligence as we design things, manufacture things, buy things, regulate them. We're not doing due diligence. And so we've got problems.
Well, thank you for all of that, and thank you for all of your important work on this and other issues. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Katie Singer. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.